I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The Trump administration announced that it would not defend the Affordable Care Act against a recent challenge to the law led by the state of Texas. The Department of Justice sided with 20 states that argue, among a number of things, that the provision guaranteeing coverage for people with pre-existing conditions is unconstitutional. The Kaiser Family Foundation found that a majority of Americans like this part of the Affordable Care Act, and that more than 50 million adults qualify for this coverage. And since we're in an election year, health care is topping the list of issues people say they care about, so there are political risks to dismantling the current health care system. Robert Field joining us once again on Radio Times, as he often does, to talk about the Affordable Care Act. He's a professor of law at Drexel University's Klein School of Law, also a professor of health management and policy at the School of Public Health at Drexel University. He's a lecturer in healthcare management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Had an op-ed in today's Philadelphia Inquirer. Robert Field, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you here. And again, to our listeners, and in this portion of the show, we are talking about healthcare. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, before we talk about all the efforts to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, this has been going on since 2010. How much of the ACA still exists?
So I would say 95 to 99% of the ACA still exists, a lot of it in ways that most people don't see. There's a lot buried under the exchanges. For example, the Medicaid expansion, which is another hot political issue, but is responsible for something like 15 to 20 million people newly getting coverage. It's also a lightning rod with the addition of work requirements and other changes that some of the states want to do. Beneath that, you have changes to the way Medicare reimburses hospitals and doctors, the whole provision for accountable care organizations, ACOs, which are groups of doctors and hospitals that try to meet goals for efficiency and quality. There are hundreds of those around the country. Some of them are experiments that have done very well and are really changing the way providers think about healthcare, instituting population health management to try to control chronic diseases. Beneath that, we have bundled payments, which are paying hospitals for whole episodes, a single payment, for instance, for a hip replacement, and then the hospital divvies it up so you don't have different providers running the meter. Beneath that, you have the coverage for adult children up to the age of 26. Staying on their parents' policies.
That's still there?
That's very much still there, unless this lawsuit succeeds.
Yeah.
And then you have a whole separate provision that has to do with specialty drugs and generic versions of those and the pathway to FDA approval of that. And we have really a transformation of the biotechnology industry. So there are many, many moving parts here, again, most of which the average patient wouldn't see.
Are people still signing up?
People are definitely still signing up. Now, we'll see what happens at the end of this year. Last year, there was speculation that we would have a lot fewer signups because the Trump administration shortened the period for signing up, and it did away with a lot of the advertising to let people know about it. And yet, the numbers were within a million or so of what they had been the year before. The big question now is, will the changes going on now change that? In particular, in the tax bill last year, Congress did away with the mandate penalty, which is the subject of this lawsuit. So will young, healthy people continue to buy insurance when there's really no penalty for not doing it?
Well, I do want to, one of the reasons you're here is to do exactly what you just did, which is to explain in plain language what our healthcare system is, largely speaking. Now, it's interesting that the Congress tried to dismantle the healthcare system, and it looks like that didn't really work.
Right.
So now the states are getting involved, and
right.
This Texas case involving, as you say, for people who don't sign up under the Affordable Care Act, there was a penalty for that, which was interpreted as a tax. Tell us what this lawsuit is all about.
Sure. So this lawsuit popping up, it's part of this game of whack-a-mole where the ACA overcomes one obstacle and another one just pops its head up. 20 attorneys general, all from Republican states, are claiming that because the power of Congress to institute the mandate is part of its taxing power, And that was decided by the Supreme Court in the first ACA case in 2012.
In fact, that was Robert's argument, right?
That was exactly. He said it couldn't be seen as a regulation requiring individuals, but it could be seen as a tax. Right. And basically, you either have insurance or you pay the tax, sort of like you can buy a hybrid car and save some tax money or buy a gas guzzler and pay your full taxes. With the amount of the penalty reduced to zero, basically the tax goes away. Their argument is therefore if it's not a tax, it's no longer constitutional under that decision. What doesn't make sense to me and is perplexing a lot of legal scholars is if the penalty is reduced to zero, then there isn't a mandate. So if the mandate had disappeared, how can it be unconstitutional? But that is their claim. I have not seen a single legal scholar who believes there's any credence to this. There's even an additional argument that even if it is somehow unconstitutional, the tax still exists. It just has been zeroed out for now, and there's ample precedent for governments at all levels suspending a tax. Philadelphia may do it for Amazon if we get their headquarters.
Sure.
So it doesn't mean that it's gone away. I think this is not about legal doctrine. This is about politics.
Well, let me ask you some non-legal questions. So
sure.
If you take away the mandate, which I guess is if there isn't a penalty, there isn't a mandate, does the system begin to fall apart because it's based on the idea of getting healthy young people into the system?
Right. Well, that's the $64,000 mm-hmm. question, and we're going to see what happens mm-hmm. next year. We already have a lot of people who are not paying buying insurance mm-hmm. and not paying the penalty. They're kind of below the radar and slipping through the cracks. Will there be more of them next year? We right. don't know. Insurers can deal with this to some extent by raising their prices to cover the added cost of having a disproportionately sick population. There's a limit to how much they can do that. But so far, it seems like they can control this with prices.
What is the appetite, though, for getting rid of the provision that covers people with pre-existing conditions? I mean, realize And I looked at Kaiser, and it's something like, in terms of adults, more than 50 million adults qualify for this provision.
And that provision is wildly popular among Democrats and Republicans, and it's even popular among Republicans in Congress. The legal argument is that the law is so intertwined that if the courts were to throw out one part, i.e. the mandate, they'd have to throw out everything else. The attorneys general are saying it would have to be everything, including the specialty drug provisions and everything else. The Trump administration just says it's the provisions for the marketplace, including the guarantee of coverage. That is a very frivolous legal argument, I believe. It's also politically very dangerous because the mandate is so popular. Mm-hmm. And you can see even yesterday in hearings in the Senate, Republican senators were scrambling to explain that they still want to see the guaranteed coverage and they're not agreeing with that part of it.
So is it attorneys general, Republican attorneys general
right.
against Republicans in Congress?
It could well be. And I think what you're seeing is a distinction between the attorneys general,
right.
Who are from red states, who are trying to please a base. And when they hear Obamacare, they flare up even redder. And those in Congress who are playing to more of a national audience, that includes more moderates.
Are there attorneys general from blue states that are also part of our legal
right.
system fighting to retain parts of the Affordable Care Act or
right.
the act itself?
Right. So what happened is the attorneys general from 16 or 17 Democratic states said, wait a second, we can play this game as well. We're going to come in and defend the law. Now, when they announced that, they thought that they would be partners with the administration. Now they're on their own, but they're the ones who are going to carry the ball. If they weren't doing that, then the lawsuit would be in strange territory.
So is the Trump administration, are they just playing a neutral party by not getting involved, or have they picked a side?
They've definitely picked a side. They have told the court that they not just are they not going to defend the law, but they are siding with the Republican mm-hmm. attorneys general. And they wrote a letter to Congress saying that that's their position.
And if memory serves me right, President Trump had said the pre-existing conditions would be protected.
Would be off the table.
He said off the table.
During the campaign. He said that during the debates over the ACA. He also said that changes to Medicare and Medicaid would be off the table, and there have been plenty of proposals along those lines. So this would not be the first contradiction.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I've got some comments coming in. That's Robert Field. He's a professor of law at Drexel University's Klein School of Law, also a professor of health management and policy at the School of Public Health at Drexel University. One of the reasons that we have him come in when we need to talk about our health care system and specifically the Affordable Care Act. And we're talking about a number of challenges to the act coming from attorneys general from red states, but as we just heard, a number of attorneys general from blue states are fighting back. Here's a tweet. What about the assertion that Obamacare hurts small businesses by requiring them to offer health care? The ACA has been in effect for a number of years. Are small businesses hurt? And I remember doing shows with you where this was an issue that came up.
Right. Yes, I think there are. Not all of them by any means. But, you know, there's a cutoff. If you have 50 or more employees, you have to provide them with coverage. Below that, you don't.
Right.
So if you're at that magic dividing line, you're not a big business. This is a major expense. I think that's one of those aspects of the law that could be fixed, that would make it operate more smoothly. Had it not been for the hyper-partisan rushed way in which it was passed, issues like that might have been smoothed over. If the day ever comes, I'm not holding my breath, if the day ever comes for true bipartisan work on improving the ACA, that would be something to address. But it absolutely is one of the shortcomings of the law.
Ben asks, why isn't it unconstitutional to require a hospital to care for a patient without guarantees that they'll be paid? I mean, is there a guarantee that hospitals will get paid? Let's say someone doesn't have insurance.
Right.
They're in a car accident. They go to a hospital to get care. What happens?
What happens is they would have to stabilize you. They don't have to fully treat you. They would have to stabilize you to the point where you could be discharged or sent to another hospital.
And then eat the costs?
Well, they would bill you. If you had insurance, they would bill the insurance. If you don't, they would bill you. But what happens is if you have no assets, if you're poor, they would eventually give up. So in essence, they would eat the cost. Legally, the answer is that they do this through Medicare. And what they say is if you want to participate in Medicare, you have to offer an open emergency room. So it's not actually a regulation. It's similar to the distinction that was made in the ACA case where they said you can't directly regulate what people do, but you can indirectly affect it with a tax. Here they're saying federal government can't regulate the hospitals directly, but it can affect their Medicare reimbursement.
Speaking of Medicare, and again, we've talked enough about health care that the issue of single payer has come up. And you described just all the complexities, all the moving parts. Would that be, in a perfect world, an easier way and maybe a less expensive way to deliver health care in America?
Okay. It could be. The problem is single payer is not a single concept. If you look around the world, every other developed country has a system that guarantees coverage for everyone, and every country has its own system. There are no two that are alike. So when Bernie Sanders was talking about Medicare for all, even that isn't very specific. 30% of Medicare is private coverage. It's basically an Obamacare-type system where you pick a competing private plan. Canada has a system where each province provides the insurance, and there are not competing private plans. So it depends what you mean by single payer.
Right.
However, if you did have all of the claims go through an single insurance mechanism and have a single set of networks and reimbursement and so forth, it would absolutely make it cheaper and more efficient.
Do you see the dismantlement of the Affordable Care Act as you look into your crystal ball? Is that going to happen?
Yeah. I strongly doubt it. And as I said at the beginning, there are so many other provisions in this that I don't see Congress doing away with the specialty drug provisions or with the accountable care organizations or with the help for adult children. In terms of the exchanges, it seems like the administration's policy is to keep trying to undermine it, to make it as shaky as possible and hope they'll spook the insurers into leaving. So far, that hasn't worked. I think that's the greatest risk. Remember something else, though. About 16 blue states have their own exchanges. And they tend to be doing very well. They tend to be very stable. Vermont is likely to become the third state to have a state-level mandate. So I think even if at the federal level things fell apart, we would have a lot of states with their own exchanges. I'm beginning to think we're going to have a two-tiered system in this country, a red healthcare system and a blue healthcare system, wow. And it's going to depend where you live.
And who gets the better care out of those systems?
Right, right. So, would
someone living in a blue state get more health care, better health care?
Well, that's what I would say. If your state has its own exchange, it's much more likely to be stable and functional. You're more likely to have the Medicaid expansion. And that's not just important for the patients. That's important for the providers. Hospitals have a tremendous amount at stake in this, and so do a lot of physicians and other providers.
Well, I would assume if we're talking about the insurance industry or the system broadly speaking, they want stability.
Right.
I mean, because I assume they do some future planning and you need stability for that. It seems that, since 2010, they've been dealing with instability.
They have, and a lot of them have dropped out of the markets, as we've seen, and a lot of them have raised prices, as we've seen. But there still is a core of insurers who are in it, and many of them are making a profit. And I think there is a path to stability here if they weren't getting these external shocks every few months. Insurers are in the business of managing risk, of managing uncertainty.
Sure.
So what's toxic to them is too much uncertainty. But so far, at least some of them have been able to contain it.
Do you think the Affordable Care Act will go back to the Supreme Court or some portions of it or perhaps even the portions we've been talking about?
It is possible that this case we've been talking about will make it to the Supreme Court. Now, from where I sit, it seems so ludicrous, the claims that they're making, it's hard to imagine it would survive even the trial court or even the next level of appeal. And there's a good chance the Supreme Court wouldn't take it, but it could well go back to the Supreme Court. I think the issue is the timing. It would take a couple of years before that happened. Probably after the next presidential election, and so the whole dynamic could be very different by then.
Almost out of time here, but I mentioned in my introduction, and this was from Kaiser and some others, that healthcare appears to be on the top of a lot of voters' lists.
Yeah, it is itself a chronic ailment.
It keeps
yes. coming back. 1992, Bill Clinton rode that into the White House, and you remember Harris Wofford in Pennsylvania mm-hmm. won a Senate seat because of that. That was a time when premiums and costs were rising very rapidly. Now that we're seeing this instability, it comes back to people's radar screens. So I think it's there. Sometimes it's in a latent state, but it pops up and reemerges, and I think we're in one of those cycles.
And political risks for those that want to take it apart?
Political risks. I think even more there are political benefits for those who can position themselves as being able to do something about it, or at least understanding people's concerns.
Hmm. Well, on that note, Robert Field, as always, thank you for coming in and joining us today on Radio Times. Again, professor of law, also professor of health management at Drexel University. And he did have an op-ed in today's Philadelphia Inquirer. You can check that out as well. We're going to take another short break and talk about something else after this very short break about voting and purges. Stay with us. We'll be right back.